Hello and welcome to the Communication Corner. I'm your host, Dr. Bill Lampton on WBCX-FM. Voice of Brunel, you're on 89.1 FM, where every Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. we talk about the issues that you are talking about every day. And we invite experts to share their ideas and comments to help us understand today's most challenging problems and opportunities. Ordinarily, my co-host is Christina Rhodes. Christina could not be with us this morning. We all wish her well. Look forward to your quick return, Christina. After you had a whirlwind trip to New Jersey this past weekend, we'll want to hear all about that. In Christina's place as my program producer for the day, I welcome Chet White. Chet has been a long-time volunteer with WBCX-FM. Because like many of us who volunteer their time and service, he's very fond of radio. However, he recently came full-time onto the staff as a WBCX-FM staff member. Chet, good morning to you.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Great, great. Happy to be working with you. Now, I know even though you've taken an administrative position with the station, you still have your regular program. Tell us about that, please.
Yes, Bill. I do a jazz program on Thursday evenings from 8 p.m. to midnight. And it's playing jazz you normally don't hear, a little on the outside, not as much traditional, but a music that we like to say we blur the boundary. So,
well, just for curiosity, how did you happen to get fascinated with jazz?
Oh, God, that goes back to when I was a kid. My older sister would play jazz, and it just kind of infected me back then. So I would say probably about 1969. Yeah, and been listening ever since.
Well, I grew up near New Orleans,
okay,
about 100 miles away, so I guess that could be called the heartland of jazz,
yes,
couldn't it?
Oh, yes.
Well, great to have you here today and appreciate your fine service. You and I have known each other since I came onto the WBCX scene, but this is our first opportunity to welcome you and to work together, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
You know, one thing, thinking about radio, Chet, before we introduce our guest, I want to say that you and I both are involved in radio because we know its significance. We know its importance to people, not just for entertainment, but for news and sometimes even for their own safety. Those of us who've been watching what has been happening in Joplin, Missouri in the last day or two, we know very well that it's the communication system that helps keep people alive, that keeps their hopes strong. Just for a personal incident, when I was on the faculty at the University of Georgia, in 1973, my wife and I had just bought a home there. There were two tornadoes that came into Athens in 1973, one of them in late March, the other one in late May, exactly 60 days apart. I can still remember so well that Charles Giddens was the station manager of WRFC. I happened to know Charles quite well because just before we had moved into our house, Charles Giddens was our next-door neighbor in Terra Apartments. Well, when the tornado was approaching, Charles Giddens and his staff went on the air, warned us, told us what to do. My wife and I, fortunately, had a portable radio. We got in the hallway with our children, put mattresses around us, and I remember very well that the station, being able to pick it up, being able to hear where things were and to know what was coming and when it was passed, what a comfort that was to us. So, Chet, I'm sure communication has been very powerful and helpful for the people in Joplin, Missouri, too.
Oh, yes, without a doubt. You know, I was just driving in, and I heard on the radio they were talking about how important the radio has been,
yes,
to Joplin.
Yeah. Yes, so it's, yes, it's great for entertainment, music, updates, everything, but it can be a lifesaver as well. And now to move along to our guest for today, Brett Broughton. Brett and I met several months back, almost a year ago now, when I was directing a program on public speaking for the Greater Hall Chamber of Commerce. Brett attended that. Afterwards, we greeted each other. He let me know, first of all, that he had been a speech communication major at the University of Minnesota. had maintained a strong interest in communication. We became acquainted, became friends, shared coffee. And the more I got to know about him, the more I knew that WBCX friends in the Communication Corner would like to hear about Brett's fantastic, interesting career. Now, we share the interest of speech communication, but I'll have to say that there are a couple of things we do not share, and I'm glad we don't. One is that he grew up in International Falls, Minnesota, Chet. My gosh, every time you hear the weather forecast in the winter, what is mentioned most? International Falls, Minnesota. And spent some time in Fargo, North Dakota. Brett, I've got to tell you, neither one of those would be very good for my golf game schedule. Not at all. Well, Brett is with us today to help us understand some of the most perplexing news items that confront us every day. The role of the Customs Service, immigration laws, smuggling, border control, similar fascinating topics, because Brett spent 29 years working in the U.S. Homeland Security. In fact, Brett, I mentioned to you before the program today that I was in Savannah visiting family this past weekend. I looked and the vehicle in the lane next to me had written on the side of it, Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Immigration. And I said, my gosh, has Brett Broughton followed me over here? Brett, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you here, and we know we're going to learn a lot. As I said, 29 years in the Department of Homeland Security. Before we get into specific topics, I'm sure it would be helpful for our listeners if you would trace your professional career for us before you retired from government service. You had a very fascinating career. Tell us about the agencies that you worked for and with, what your functions were, and how that led you to the position where you can share some topics with us today.
Well, thank you, Bill. As you have already said, I grew up in International Falls, Minnesota, which is a border town right on the Canadian border with Ontario. And having grown up in the border town, of course, we all became familiar with customs. And one thing I will say in defense of International Falls, it is the location for Rocky and Bullwinkle, Frostbite Falls. That's where they get it from. So we do have a little bit of that going on as well, a little anecdotal. But nonetheless, they have an increase in traffic in the summer months. And as a result of that, they need people to come on, you know, on a part-time basis. And
not much traffic in the winter months.
No, not really. Local traffic in Boise Cascade, which used to be the paper industry up there, has trucks and trains traveling across the border. So I became involved as a seasonal inspector back in 1981. I worked two summers, graduated from college. In 1983, took a position in Pima, North Dakota, right on the border.
What would you do as a seasonal inspector in summer as a college student? What were some of your duties?
We would do everything the inspectors did with the exception of entry of commercial cargo because we weren't trained. So essentially, we were going through people's dirty laundry in their suitcases, counting fish, and making seizures if anything was against the law. And we operated solely under the purview of the inspectors that were there. So we were just the step, I won't use that term, but we were the go-to people when traffic increased and we climbed in the back of vehicles more likely than not. And that took up, I would say, 6 months of time being a seasonal inspector 3 months at a time. Later in 83, became full-time inspector, Pembina, North Dakota, on the Canadian border with Manitoba. Moved down to St. Louis, Missouri, not too far from Joplin. And from there, became a special agent with the U.S. Customs Service at the time. Came back to Minnesota and Minneapolis to be near family in 1985. And then later, at the end of my career, transferred from there to Duluth, Minnesota, where I became the resident agent in charge of a staff of special agents and responsible for the entire northeast quadrant of Minnesota, the upper fourth, I would say, of the state. And so we oversaw all the investigations and took referrals for investigation from the inspectors that I had worked with.
One of the things that I can say just from a little experience, one trip into Canada, is that the Canadian border, getting into Canada and then coming back into the United States, that is still, in my limited experience, that is one of the most carefully controlled borders that I know of. I have a friend in England who has traveled to, I believe he said, 60 or 70 countries. He said no country is more difficult to get into and to get out of than Canada, that they are very rigid, they're extremely thorough. My wife and I had driven up from Seattle. We'd flown to Seattle. We rented a car in Seattle, drove, and we just thought it would be a matter of, hi, here we are, and here's our ID. However, when I stopped and talked to the man, and he said, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm presenting a program in Canada, and I thought that sounded bland enough. He said, what are you talking on? And I told him what my speech and seminar topics were. He said, I believe we need to talk to you further. So they brought me inside, and I found that there was no joviality. There was no welcome to Canada. There was no upbeat joking or joshing. It was very, very serious. We were there for 45 minutes. And at the same time, they had these vehicles that were sliding under cars, including our rental car that had mirrors on them, where you could look up under the car to see if there was anything being smuggled there. So just again, from my limited international experience, I've been to, I don't know, 15 or 20 other countries, and Canada still remains, in my experience and that of a friend of mine, extremely stringent. However, that may be why we don't read about them having some of the problems that the U.S. has.
Canada is very revenue-driven. They are very careful with what type of groceries you bring into the country, how much chicken. I mean, there's still a fair amount of smuggling of groceries going northbound, believe it or not. In terms of fishermen going north, you have to take pickled minnows to Canada because they do not want you bringing live bait for the purposes of keeping our infectious diseases on our side. So people go up there with jars of minnows because any live bait you might want to bring in, your favorite bait, will be confiscated at the border. But by and large, Canada and Revenue Canada is revenue-driven by virtue of its title. The U.S. is not so much concerned with that. They, however, are.
So what they're trying to do is if you want a product, you don't bring it in, you buy it there?
Exactly. And also, based on the fact that you were going there to lecture, they would presume that was employment. And they want to reserve any sorts of occasions like that for Canadian citizens. Mm-hmm. So that would have explained why you went through this really stringent examination. It's kind of a non-tariff barrier to people not coming into work in Canada. And that's just another means of doing it, making it not so easy to come there to do your job.
And so they even asked me how much I was going to be paid for the presentation.
Exactly.
All surprising questions. Brett, we've heard about the Customs Service, many of us. We read about it in the news. We hear about it on newscasts. Maybe we heard something about it in our civics programs. What really was the origin of the Customs Service, and how did it develop into what we know today?
Well, the Customs Service was founded back in 1789. Probably the most notable action of the revenue it raised was for the Louisiana Purchase. The Customs Service existed happily up until 2003 with the merger under Immigration Customs Enforcement. Prior to that time, it was a well-functioning, as much as you can expect, agency that was responsible for collection, protection of the revenue, and interdiction of dangerous flows of narcotics. Probably the salad days for the Customs Service were back during Reagan years under Commissioner William Von Raab, a very enforcement-oriented fellow that I think had his sights set on the FBI, but it didn't come to pass. So he did a very remarkable job with Customs Service. In fact, he is best known for closing down the southwest border when a DEA agent, Enrique Camarena, was assassinated doing his work in Mexico. Commissioner Von Raab said, we're going to shut down that border. And we're going to open every trunk of every car based on information that they were going to smuggle his corpse back into the country, the Mexican cartels, and essentially dump him in the desert somewhere. And we were going to make sure that that didn't happen, not on his watch. So he started opening every trunk of every car that crossed from Mexico into the United States, which then slowed down traffic and slowed down business. And the people that kicked up the greatest fuss were the businessmen down there who said, you have to stop. In which case it did stop based on the pressure they applied. But I would say of all the enforcement actions, that was probably what comes to mind.
Interesting background. Before we go farther with it, I'll ask our guest program producer today, Chet White, to remind us where we are and who our guest is.
You're listening to the Communication Corner with your host, Dr. Bill Lampton, on WBCX 89.1 FM, the voice of Bernal. We invite you to join us every Tuesday at 9 a.m. and our rebroadcast at 6 a.m. on Thursday. Bill's guest today is Brent Broughton, who shares what he learned about national security during his long career with the U.S. Homeland Security Department. Later today, you can hear the podcast of this program on Dr. Bill's blog, whose web address is thecompletecommunicator.com. In fact, on his blog, you'll find the podcast of Bill's interviews and more than 40 previous guests. Again, that blog address is thecompletecommunicator.com.
Yes, Chet, and after the program today, you'll take a photo of me and Brett together. We'll have that on the blog as well. And on the blog, I will certainly have Brett's contact information for those who definitely will want to follow up with him. Well, getting back to the origin of the Customs Service, any more you wanted to say about that, Brett?
Well, leading up, the mission was fairly clear. Customs was concerned with merchandise, with cargo, with drugs. And it was fairly defined. The relationships among the agencies that played a role was clearly defined, easily understood. And we proceeded in a rational, logical way in the enforcement from the time of the interdiction, passing the information and the body if one was detained or arrested to agents who then presented that for prosecution. There was no confusion between inspectors, agents, and other enforcement personnel like the U.S. Border Patrol that, of course, operates on both north and south southern borders. And I would say that sums up nicely what things were like prior to 2003.
What has changed since 2003 and why?
Well, there's a saying we go back to. I can't attribute it exactly, but the saying we found that we have all enjoyed in watching reorganizations occur is from quite some time ago, where this person said, "We tried hard, but it seemed that every time we were beginning to form up into effective teams, we would be reorganized. I was to learn that later in life, we tend to meet any new situation by reorganizing. And a wonderful method it can be for creating the illusion of a progress while producing confusion, inefficiency, and demoralization." And that was attributed to Petronius Arbiter, a proconsul of Bithynia, in 66 A.D. So they've been doing it for quite some time.
Well, as you were saying that, I was remembering many organizations that I have worked with. I spent more than 20 years in higher education, one reason I feel very much at home on the Bernal University campus. I also spent 20 years as a professional fundraiser, and now since 1997, I've worked freelance with a variety of organizations. That could sound familiar with almost any organization. If you want people to think you're making progress, just reorganize. Do a lot of paperwork. Shift around the organizational chart. Give people new titles, new supposed responsibilities. And as you're saying, Brett, in the meantime, what is really getting accomplished?
Well, what's getting accomplished is putting the Hatfields and McCoys under the same roof together. Up until 2003, closer to 2003, the customs folks, whether or not this was accurate, but the common word on the street was the Immigration Naturalization Service was going to be eliminated as an agency. Now it's resurrected like from the ashes of the phoenix, and they get top billing, and the customs people are none the happier for it, because now we also have folded into what used to be an easy mission, immigration, which reads like the tax law. No one understands it. There are loopholes galore. The refugees that come here come contrary to a lot of the laws that are on the books because they are exceptions. Now the mission has grown from this collect and protect the revenue, interdict the dangerous flow of narcotics, to one of four key priorities which have been outlined in the 2010 fiscal year plan through 2014. The four priorities are prevent terrorism, enhance security, protect borders against illicit trade, travel, and finance, protect the borders through smart and tough interior immigration enforcement, construct efficient, effective agency. Those are the missions. With the expansion of any organization, whether it's public or private sector, based on this perceived notion that the efficiency will increase, it just typically doesn't play out that way. What happened then, as I discussed moments ago about this clear enforcement division of labor has now become so muddied that there is as much, I'll say, tension between agencies fighting over the same piece of pie that never existed before. Conditions where, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, so other agencies sense a vacuum created by this reorganization, they rush to fill it, trampling on other agencies who historically has been responsible for a particular aspect of the mission. So this has become somewhat of a mess because agencies are saying, well, do they really do the investigations? ICE, in fact, was a title that we as an agency fought against, but because another government agency said we don't want criminal investigations and enforcement, CIE being the title, we want something else because it too closely mirrors what we do.
So what is ICE? I know it's an acronym. ICE, what organization is that?
It's part of Homeland Security, Immigration, Customs Enforcement. Now has been renamed to Homeland Security Investigations, HSI from ICE. There's another name change. I guess it makes people feel better of not having the ICE moniker attached to the mission. That's purely for the result of the change.
When you go up the organizational chart, and we've said the organizational chart has changed many times, Brett, when you go up the organizational chart, who's at the top? Who has responsibility for this? Is it, the average citizen doesn't know. Is it the Attorney General? Is it, who would that be? Who's the top cabinet member, maybe?
Janet Napolitano currently is. So she is a secretary, a cabinet-level position. And typically what happens is the management present day has been pushed upwards where it's been taken away from the 26 special agent in charge offices that are located throughout the country, which employs upwards of 10,000 people, 6,700 roughly are agents. So much of the decision making is from top down that the local offices that could readily and easily address the issues now are under the gun to comply with the political whimsy of what's going on in the Beltway. So a lot of people are scratching their heads saying, what do we do now? We need to get approval. So you can imagine that the parking brake is applied on a lot of missions that could otherwise be accomplished quickly and efficiently.
Over organization is complicating, slowing down, creating more inefficiency?
Absolutely true. The Minneapolis office, for example, the ratio of manager to employee has grown out of proportion where it's too many folks in charge. Decisions aren't quickly done. Because there are so many in charge, they have to parse the mission up into minuscule parts that another person by himself could say, I will take this group of taskings and attend to it. But meanwhile, now you have another layer that says, okay, I will then take part of what you're otherwise responsible for. And it's just a matter of even knowing who to speak to get the decision made. Oftentimes there's confusion that reigns and people don't know, but it does slow everything down.
What would it take to clarify that, to create a smoother organization? What would have to be done?
I think downsizing, as an outsider now, I think downsizing in a sensible way would accomplish a lot. I think but once again, I think any agency out there is politically driven. So the caprice of the day by the whatever political forces are in play in the Beltway dictate the missions. For example, Immigration Customs Enforcement under George Bush towards the end of his career administration were worksite enforcement oriented. That does not sit well present day. So now the emphasis has been moved from worksite to intellectual property rights because it's more neutral in the fact it doesn't have the emotional consequence of worksite.
Explain to us what we mean by intellectual property, please.
Intellectual property is essentially the function of Customs Border Protection and Immigration Customs Enforcement or Homeland Security Investigations to protect those folks who have copyrights and trademarks that they've recorded with the Customs Service. That would be things like Louis Vuitton handbags, Rolex watches, things that are everywhere on the streets of New York and Washington, things that U.S. attorneys across the country say, where is the victim in this? How are we to enforce something which is rampant throughout our country?
People carrying designer handbags, for example. Counterfeit ones, is that what you're saying?
Correct. So anywhere, you know, you can just about bump into anyone on the street carrying a Louis Vuitton handbag. There are certain things you look for that will identify it as legitimate. For example, on just a purse, the seam that goes on the purse to hold it together should not cross through the mark. So all the marks, the LV or whatever they use, should be intact. You should not have that intersected by a seam or by ribbing. And that's how you can tell counterfeit from legit.
Now, that's something that a professional would know. The problem is the average consumer won't know those things, will they?
They won't. And I think one of the things that has a direct impact on consumers, there is a flood of electronic devices, merchandise that have been coming into this country for quite some time, bearing counterfeit Underwriters Laboratories marks, which commonly seen as a UL mark. Each time, each year, there has to be an examination of how are the counterfeiters, and I will say China has been the primary source for this, how are they getting around our current mark? So now we have to do holograms. We have to modify this character so it doesn't go all the way. There's modifications done, and the counterfeiters catch up with it. Now, the counterfeit UL mark is something we became involved with. We had a nationwide recall of electronic fans that had a counterfeit mark on them. Now, that's not to say if you plug them in, they could burst into flames, but needless to say that the purpose of UL is to test for safety. If you have these items coming in bearing counterfeit marks, they have not been tested. So the consuming public at large could be more at risk in using this device, bearing this label with confidence, thinking it's all right. They plug it in and their house burns down. I'm not saying it's happened, but it is a risk that we are being subjected to most often unwittingly, where you go into department stores, you see an article there marked, and you think this is fine. It has a UL label. If you're paying attention, you take it home, and it is otherwise. Then,
so these are not really sold on the streets. They're sold in legitimate places.
Absolutely. Department stores, I don't know anything current because a lot of my attention towards the end of my career, and being that I've been away for 2 years, has been shifted away. But a lot of what you're finding now with this are sporting material, shirts, hats, things that bear the labels Major League Baseball or NFL teams, NBA teams. A lot of this is counterfeit with a Far East origin. Chinese manufacturers are making a lot of money doing that, and they're not going to stop anytime soon.
Is the only way to stop this at borders?
There is a means of consumers calling customs if they come across, if they happen to be savvy enough. But yes, borders is the choke point. There are so many ways. For example, some folks are bringing in an unmarked item from overseas, from a Far East source. It is then sent to Mexico, where in Mexico the emblem is attached to that article, like a shirt, for example, with an NBA team on it, and then shipped back to the United States. And because of the sheer volume of traffic, the things are not being checked or are more apt to get by if they see a Mexican source versus a Far East source, which would then heighten the interest in looking at that particular shipment. In addition, quickly getting to, there are certain prerogatives that the government gets involved with to speed up trade. The whole mission of customs, I think, for the last long time, now Immigration Customs, Customs Border Protection, is to facilitate trade in the safest manner possible, reducing the threat of terrorism, but at the same time, success is determined by how quickly the merchandise gets into our country. There are systems set up now where if companies are part of what they call a customs trade partnership against terrorism, their merchandise is less likely to be examined because they are part of it, so it goes shooting through into our commerce.
We'll continue in just a minute with our wonderful guest, Brett Broughton, on this tremendously important topic that he has special insights on. For the moment, though, let's have a reminder where we are, what's going on, station ID, with Chet White, who's substituting as program producer today for my regular co-host, Christina Rhodes. Chet?
You're listening to the Communication Corner with your host, Dr. Bill Lampton, on WBCX 89.1 FM, the voice of Bernal. We invite you to join us every Tuesday at 9 a.m. and our rebroadcast at 6 a.m. on Thursday. Bill's guest today is Brett Brockton, who shares what he learned about national security during his long career with the U.S. Homeland Security Department. Later today, you can hear the podcast of this program on Dr. Bill's blog, whose web address is thecompletecommunicator.com. In fact, on his blog, you'll find the podcast of Bill's interviews with more than 40 previous guests. Again, that blog address is thecompletecommunicator.com.
My name is Joe Thompson. I'm 29 years old and have a career that I love as a systems analyst. Career. It still sounds cool to say that word. I never could have gotten on this path without a college degree. And if the college me were here, he'd tell you.
I never would have gotten to college without big brothers, big sisters. I could have ended up anywhere, on the streets even. But college? Joe Thompson? Not likely. My big brother helped me out. He taught me I could do anything. At a time when a lot of people were saying just the opposite.
And to a 7-year-old, that means a lot. My big brother's name is Phil. And Phil is the reason that this 7-year-old grows up to be a systems analyst.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping big brothers, big sisters help a child. And that can last a lifetime. Start something today at bigbrothersbigsisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
I can solve difficult problems for a Fortune 500 company.
I can run a successful business.
I can manage your home improvements.
I can publicize your message.
I can motivate your audience.
I can put my military experience to work for your company.
I can teach your children.
I can boost your bottom line.
I can add value to your workplace.
I could be a loyal and productive employee.
But I can't put my skills to work for your organization
if I'm not given the opportunity.
If you don't recognize my talents and ability.
If you don't hire me.
If you don't have an open mind and a workplace that's open to everyone.
If you don't realize that America works best when everybody works.
What can you do?
What can you do?
What can you do?
You can remember that it works.
It's what people can do.
It's what people can do that matters.
Nearly 50 million Americans have disabilities. Capitalize on their talents with employment practices that benefit everyone. Learn more at whatcanyoudocampaign.org.
In the beloved fairy tale classic, Beauty and the Beast, Belle is imprisoned in the castle of a mysterious beast. But with the assistance of the castle's enchanted staff, the two become unlikely friends, discover that true beauty is found within, and they live happily ever after.
Today, our happily ever afters are being threatened by the fact that nearly 1 in 3 children in America are overweight or obese. Now more than ever, it's time to make good nutrition and physical activity part of your family's daily lifestyle. Do things like eat dinner together, add fruits and veggies to every meal, save treats for special occasions, and get up and play an hour each day. Be our guest to healthy living and visit letsmove.gov to learn more. That's letsmove.gov. This message has been brought to you by Let's Move, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Ad Council.
89.1 WBCX, Gainesville and Northeast Georgia, the voice of Bernal.
And you're listening to the Communication Corner. I'm your host, Dr. Bill Lampton. As we move into the second half with our guest, Brett Broughton, we've had a most informative, lively first half hour talking about some of the key topics that all of us are talking about every day and we need an expert's guidance on, and we're fortunate to have Brett with us, who spent 29 years with Homeland Security. Brett, during the break, you said there was a little bit more that you wanted to expand on what we were talking about. What was that, please?
Thank you, Bill. What I was getting at is the mission of Customs is twofold. First of all, it's to protect the revenue, and secondly, not to impede the flow of what otherwise is legitimate merchandise into the United States. And sometimes it's a fairly myopic approach where we forget about one in favor of the other. A story that was told back when I was in training in our training facility as a federal law enforcement training center here in Brunswick, Georgia, where everyone who is working in certain divisions within the government trains. So I've been down there several times through the course of my career. the way the story was told to us, and it was, I think, at the time, probably the early 80s, Japan has a policy of inspecting virtually every baseball bat that goes to their country that's imported. So as a result of the non-tariff barrier, the Japanese consignees looking to import are less likely to do so because their merchandise is held up at a port of entry because each baseball bat has to be inspected. Now, that certainly may have changed. I don't think it was a bromide, some sort of fanciful story that was being told. But for our part, with these different programs, it's, again, the law of unintended consequences at play, where at the one point we do want to protect our borders. At the other hand, we do have the interests of businesses at heart because they have the ear of Congress if things are held up and they're losing business based on a delay of getting merchandise in. Customs Service or Customs Border Protection at this point is very attuned to what's going on. So as a result, different programs that are out there are intended. Numbers are probably massaged in a way so that it can say this is why it's being justified. So I guess what I am saying is that programs such as CTPAT, Customs Trade Partnership Against Terrorism, is designed to protect us and get merchandise here very quickly. All we have to do is look at the textile industry here in the southeast part of the country with the elimination of quota and visa restraints, non-tariff barriers, in some case tariff barriers. They have been eliminated, and we only have to look around to see what has happened to the garment industry in our country. It's no longer here. We have to pay attention, I think, as a country, to the interests of business and getting merchandise in and protecting what industry we have left.
Yes, and growing up in the Southeast as I did, I'm very aware of what you're talking about, the virtual disappearance of almost an entire industry, or at least a sizable portion of it. Brett, the Customs Service and Immigration, who are the major players and what are their functions?
Well, the organization is now, as I've said, the merger in 2003 is a response to 9/11, spearheaded by Senator Joseph Lieberman, to make this very large agency that would be better able to communicate. The immigration mission has been an eye-opener for all of those customs folks that had nothing to do with the mission historically or practically speaking their entire careers. I was one of those. In the last seven, I became exposed to the immigration mission and this tangled web of immigration laws that are out there that we then would defer to our immigration counterparts to work. So essentially, we've been blended into one agency with these huge missions, each on their own, now that we have this gargantuan mission of both customs enforcement and immigration. But it has been an eye-opener. There's one quick war story, as we're prone to tell, of a enforcement action in December of 2006 in Grand Island, Nebraska. It is a site for livestock processing. There are 6,000 head of cattle that are processed through this particular plant in any one day.
A pretty remote place, maybe?
It's in the middle of Nebraska, I'm thinking probably an hour and a half to 2 hours away from Lincoln. And the conditions are this. This is a large facility that can obviously process that many head of cattle. There's an outdoor pond which holds everything that is lost by the animals that are being processed inside the factory. And for those having any questions as to what actually is used of a cow, with the exception of probably a foot of their tail, everything is processed and used in some manner or shape. In going there, I was on the outside, and a fairly large plant. There were a fair amount of folks from undocumented workers, for the use of lack of a better term, that were working there, probably since early 2000. I was on the outside. We had a lab area that a woman was working in, a gal from the local area, an American. Without looking up from her testing, we went in there to ask her what is going on here, because there were about 600 people, I believe, being rounded up in the facility, illegal, undocumented workers. Without looking up from her work, she said, "What took you so long?" I didn't have an answer for her. I asked her what she meant by that. She said, "Americans had these jobs in the early 2000s, but when the undocumented workers kept coming across under previous administrations, the wages were going down. So finally, the wages had dropped, I think, about $2 an hour, and Americans were saying, we can't do this job anymore for that. The fellows that were inside this plant, walking through the muck that was on the floor with bone marrow that was chipped away, going on conveyor belts, dripping, raining down on them like snow. Awful conditions. But these were jobs Americans wanted at a fair wage. And with the undocumented workers coming in, you didn't have the same concerns.
What countries were the undocumented workers from?
Guatemala, Mexico, anywhere south of our southwest border, essentially, coming in. I would say, by and large, Guatemalans. But when they were taken off, the wages went back up, and Americans started coming back because the wages went back up.
Were these people deported?
They were eventually deported. I think it's usually anywhere like a 13-week process. The point, I guess, I've been trying to make, we've heard so many times, the jobs Americans don't want, and it's just patently false. It's just not the case, not in my experiences. In fact, hearing about some other raids that have occurred with, using a better term than raid, and, for example, chicken processing plants, not here, but I think in Mississippi, American workers sharing the line with undocumented workers were cheering when Immigration Customs folks came in to get them. We had workers, we had truck drivers at the Grand Island facility flashing us the victory sign like we were returning from VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, World War II veterans. It was amazing to me. I'd never experienced anything like that.
Taking the workforce back for America, in other words.
Exactly right.
Now, you said something in one of our earlier conversations, an intriguing story that you came in contact with about Chinese forced labor. Where and what was that?
This was in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It was during the lead-up to Christmas. There are more shipments that come in the fall of Christmas lights, Christmas trees, and that sort of thing. There was an occasion, actually two occasions, one of which was a videotape, I think, that was intended for Western audiences, which was to promote a site that made Christmas trees. So the video, a VHS old-style video, opens up where you have this sea of humanity somewhere over in China getting ready to march into this factory at the start of the day. I don't know how many thousands were there, but they go into this facility, and a lot of them live there in tiny little cubicles, two to a cubicle.
Live in the factory.
Live in the factory. The scene of them making these trees is these flywheels that are spinning at incredible rates with wire and no guards and hands darting in and out of this flywheel, putting materials together so the tree can be assembled. And they're saying, of course, we take care of our people. For those who are not in management, the rank and file in these Chinese factories, their infirmary is another tiny little cubicle with a jar of aspirin and some Band-Aids. Meanwhile, the management has this opulent Chinese facility akin, I guess, to a nice upscale Chinese restaurant where they get to hang out. That was one thing. Another thing we did find from a shipment of Christmas tree lights, someone happened to open it up, and on the inside of the cardboard was a message scrawled in Chinese characters that we did get translated, and we couldn't do anything about it, that said, "Help me. I am being held against my will." And there was absolutely no way to trace it and no way to help the person. We have no way of knowing if they're even still working at the factory or above ground, in fact. So this is the sort of thing we come up against in trying to enforce child labor and forced labor laws.
And there's no way of even guessing how comprehensive, how widespread the problem is, how many, maybe tens of thousands of people are victimized by it.
There's no way, because even enforcing simple trade laws in order to get around certain controls, such as controls from a particular part of, going back to China again, prior to Hong Kong being blended into China, they would take Chinese origin merchandise subject to quota or visa restraints or otherwise excludable by U.S. law, saying we're not letting this product in from this area. They would transship it, then claim it was from Hong Kong, and it would come into our country. It's not something that I can say in every case, because there are plenty of other source countries that are used as transshipment points for getting merchandise from an otherwise excluded source through this next country for which they claim its origin to get to the United States.
Brett will cover more in our remaining 15 minutes. Chet White, please tell us, anybody might have tuned in late, might wonder where they are and who they're listening to. Take care of that, and then please talk about next week's guest.
You're listening to the Communication Corner with your host, Dr. Bill Lampton, on WBCX 89.1 FM, the voice of Bernal. Next week, you'll benefit greatly by hearing Dr. Bill interview business building expert Gina Carr from Orlando, Florida. For years, Bill has referred to her as Genius Gina because she has mastered the new technology as it applies to building your business. You want to hear her innovative recommendations about Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and other popular technology. Gina will talk about mistakes to avoid and give us valuable steps to take to boost your business. So join us next Tuesday as Dr. Bill talks with Gina Carr.
Absolutely. I call her Genius Gina for a reason. When the social media started coming in several years ago, there were a few people who latched onto its potential who became sort of the gurus. Gina is one of those people. I once did a video interview of her that's posted on YouTube. People can find it there. Gina Carr, C-A-R-R, or look under my name, Bill Lampton. And so anyone who wants to grow your business through internet marketing, and most of us do, please be with us next week. Let me remind you that the current interview with Brett Broughton not only will be on my blog later today, thecompletecommunicator.com, and it will be there permanently, as are all the previous interviews. Additionally, the Communication Corner will be rebroadcasted this Thursday morning at 6 a.m. For those of you who like to start your day quite early, we'll have the full rebroadcast 6 a.m. this Thursday. One more comment to make sure you know. I love to get phone calls from you. You can reach me at the station, 770-538-4744, or I welcome your call on my cell phone, 678-316-4300. Returning for our last segment with Brett Broughton, 29 years Homeland Security professional. Brett, there's something that happens to everybody who has email. We get multiple email spam promising us money that is just waiting for us, as though we'd won the lottery practically. Millions of dollars sometimes, if we'll simply provide some simple basic information such as our credit card number or our bank account number where they can deposit it. As we've all noticed, most of these come from Nigeria, but some do come from Canada. How does the United States detect, regulate, and prosecute this fraud? And before you answer it, let me mention that I've been astonished to read how much money people invest in this spam, this scam, every year by responding and giving that information to someone overseas that they've never seen and never will see. How do you detect it, regulate it, and prosecute that fraud?
It's very difficult. Americans are very giving people and believe a lot of what is told. I know some of this that I've gone into gets very esoterical and that it's very technical. The average person out there doesn't understand, well, why are things happening to our country in a particular way as it involves customs? And that's what happens. It's just a lot of specialized information the normal person doesn't have an active interest in pursuing. Similarly, when it comes to these scams, generally, they have come out of Nigeria, where the usual email is, we're trying to get a lot of money out of the country. You can have a share, and a high-ranking official needs to get out and needs your help. And so then people wanting to be giving and believing provide the information you've mentioned, bank accounts and letterhead, and the rest is just a perpetration on their trust. What we're finding to be interesting, too, is something that's happened even closer to home in Canada, where someone posing as a Canadian immigration official calls and says, we have a large sum of money that's intended to go to you, and it will be released so you can have it, but you have to pay the duty. And this is where you send the check. So people thinking, believing, and hoping they may catch a break, respond to it and send their money. And that sort of thing happens all the time. And it's really difficult in getting the word out to everyone about it. So they most often prey on the elderly, those that do not have the savvy connected with the use of the internet being used to scam people.
Well, something else that I've read about, is that if, I can't remember, but there's a certain prefix phone number that you should not return the call. Because if you return the call, it is an out-of-the-country number. You will be charged something like $20,000 just for returning the call, and it cannot be prosecuted because they're outside of U.S. jurisdiction. Are you familiar with that scam?
I've heard of that, and I really don't have a lot more to talk about than what you've mentioned. I don't know that any ICE agencies or ICE divisions are actually involved in that, so I cannot speak to that as well.
But getting to the first picture that we mentioned, it goes back to an old saying, Brett, if something sounds too true, too good to be true, it probably is.
That's absolutely correct.
It's just not very likely that a stranger is going to be giving you tens of thousands or $500,000. It's not very likely.
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, some have said, I need a roommate. I need to be someone's roommate coming to your country. Could you please front me the money necessary to put down a deposit on an apartment? And we've had people that have then willingly and happily sent money over to someone so they could come here with some money in their pocket so they could set up some place to live.
Now, another one that has become quite common, I've had it come to me several times. I will get an email. Let's say I get one. It says it's from Brett Broughton. I know Brett, so I'm going to read it. Brett says to me, Bill, a real unfortunate thing happened to me. I'm vacationing in Paris. My wallet got stolen. A pickpocket. I'm a victim of a pickpocket. And I'm totally out of money, but here's a place where you can wire money. I know Brett Broughton. I trust him. So impulsively, I wire the money there. Brett Broughton's not involved in that at all, is he?
No, he's not. Not at all. One thing I did want to mention, I see our time is kind of drawing to a close as far as trust factors is concerned. People send their children off to universities and colleges paying a lot of money to get their kids through and having a four-year degree or advanced degrees. There is a program within our own country called the H-1B program, which is a visa program that seeks out folks from other countries that have specialized training in a number of areas too long to go into. But what is happening is the Americans that are coming out applying for a job, for example, a college graduate applies for a job at company ABC. He may or may not, he may face competition from an outside of the United States person who wants to come here. One thing I found fascinating in terms of trusting who you're working with, and this can be Googled and can be viewed on YouTube, a Pittsburgh law firm, Cohen and Grigsby, gave a training session to American business. And what happens is American businesses getting a list of candidates have to go through, identify all those who are Americans, and conduct an interview. And if the Americans pass the interview, they get the nod over the foreign-born worker. What is being set up by Cohen and Grigsby, and I think they're no longer maybe not doing it overtly, they said, let's craft an interview where there is no way that the American student, American graduate, can pass the interview. There are 85,000 H-1B visas given out each year. They are good for a total of 6 years. So do the math and come to the conclusion that with 85,000 people coming to our country to take skilled positions away from college graduates based on an interview that's been set up with questions that the U.S. folks cannot possibly answer, the H-1B folks are going to come here and work for a lot less, whether by design or by accident. American companies are doing that, saying, number one, the kids here don't have the training necessary to do the job. And, of course, that may be part of it. The second part is the foreign-born workers are going to work for a lot less. That is a continuing problem we have to be concerned with, not just the unskilled workers that are coming here. So the investment they're making for their children can be ultimately affected by the practices of the H-1B visa program, which renews itself annually.
In a sense, I think of outsourcing. This is almost the reverse of outsourcing, where you do outsourcing to other countries. In this case, you're bringing the other countries here and giving them the benefits.
Exactly.
At lower wages.
Exactly right.
We talked about Canada some at the opening of the program, and we are down to our last 5 minutes now. Most of us don't think of smuggling originating in Canada, and yet it has been a problem. Please describe a case where Rogaine came into U.S. pharmacies.
In this particular instance, the Upjohn Company had the exclusive use patent for Rogaine used in minoxidil. And what was happening, companies, pharmacies throughout the United States, and this was some years ago now, were grinding up these tablets and putting them into their own compounds, their own formulas, and selling them as a treatment for male pattern baldness. They decided that was a little too slow. So one company in particular went to Canada and identified a source that could provide the active ingredient. They would then smuggle the active ingredient through Federal Express, claiming it as raw material sample for testing under a $25 value, in which case it goes through under a section of law which precludes the examination of things of nominal value. It would then come to the United States, where it would be formulated and sold to pharmacies throughout the country, probably even here in Georgia. The money then, the funds, would be sent by way of check, similarly, either through the Postal Service or FedEx, which would then be forwarded to the source in Canada, who would then forward the uncashed checks to Barclays Bank in the Turks and Caicos Islands, where the source down there would run them through their bank account and launder the proceeds, send the money back into Canada. The supplier would keep his cut for the supply and then forward the remaining amount to the U.S. Vendor of the counterfeit Rogaine. It gets very elaborate. In fact, now the way to launder proceeds of choice is to buy these prepaid cards that are loaded up with funds that people can carry across like credit cards in a wallet that is chock full of money that can be given in lieu of taking some physical money through or across any sort of a border or go through the banking system. And that is the method of choice at this time.
I've got a daughter who's a pharmacist. I'm going to share that story with her. She'll find that most interesting. Brett, I have the privilege of knowing you off the air as well as on the air, as I said, because of our mutual interest in communication. One thing I want to make sure that our listeners are aware of is that tomorrow you begin a trip which has great family implications for you, and it has, I think, a very strong patriotic note. Share that with us, please.
My son, Ryan, is in the Minnesota National Guard. The entire state of Minnesota is being emptied out to take their turn in Kuwait, and their mission will be to escort a convoy of military equipment coming back from northern Iraq into Kuwait, where it's going to be shipped to who knows where. So he and all of his cohort will be going to that area and spending a year dedicated to that mission, which involves traveling at night, involves receiving small arms fire, and it involves detecting and defusing or getting rid of IEDs which have been placed along the way. So all of these men and women over there are in harm's way. Many are family members. My son, fortunately, is single at this point. So we really have to tip our caps to many of the armed services that are over there doing their duty on behalf of this country.
Well, and please let your son know that WBCX and WBCX listeners wish you and him well, and we appreciate his dedication and service. Hope you have a great trip and have a wonderful week with him before he is deployed.
Thank you, Bill.
Brett, it has been a true privilege having you here with us. Fascinating topic, one that most of us know very little about, and it's wonderful to have a professional with us. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Bill. You're welcome.
This is Dr. Bill Lampton thanking you for being with us in the Communication Corner, 89.1 WBCX-FM, broadcasting live on Tuesday mornings, rebroadcasted on Thursday mornings. Remember to be with us next week, please, when I will be interviewing Gina Carr from Orlando, an expert in internet marketing, a way that we can grow our business. Would love for you to contact me directly. The station number 770-538-4744. Call me on my cell phone, 678-316-4300. Again, thanks for being with us in the Communication Corner.